Good afternoon. So last time we started talking about kind of some of this cat and mouse game between malware authors and people trying to analyze or detect and stop malware. And we mentioned this kind of technique where we see a bunch of quote unquote encrypted malware where we have code that is, you know, arguably encrypted, but it's not really encryption because the key is right there. But this makes it so signature detection is hard, and so analysis is a little harder. And often this is combined by having lots of variants of code, and when replicating or producing, you know, versions of your malware, you produce a random variant of the code. And this works well with the encryption technique because we can vary the decryptor and conceptually don't need to worry about varying other parts of it. We talked about kind of a thing we do on the defense side against this is think about emulation. That if there's code that decrypts the malware, or if we just want to determine the behavior of the malware, a way we can do that is by running it in some easy to observe environment, and emulators and virtual machines give us a way of doing that. And so this is like a kind of technique, and it's kind of the simplest, relatively generic way to get past these quote unquote encrypted viruses. You can just run their decryption routine, and though it doesn't matter how complicated that routine is, it'll still do what it's supposed to do and give you the actual instructions that are supposed to run. So one thing we often see malware do is it will take steps to avoid being emulated. So it will take advantage of imperfections in our emulation or virtualization, where those are distinguishably different from the real environment, and also take advantage of the fact that if we're doing something like detection, we're going to probably run it once and not be very patient about it, whereas malware that's trying to affect a long-running system where it's booted lots of times, you know, can take advantage of that by taking a while to do its thing, using a lot of resources to do its thing, and only having its malicious activity happen relatively rarely, where over the long term, relatively rarely is eventually it will happen, but probably not in the typical malware detection if it's automated or even semi-automated. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay. And when we finished up last time, we were talking about a different strategy for making malware that always changes. We started off by having these variants. We had basically these little templates, and we'd have some generator, which is basically outputting pieces of this template, usually a generator for our decryptor. And usually it ended up being that kind of our generator was protected by this encryption, this scrambling process, and it generated the decryption code. But there's this other strategy where instead of having this kind of template, we use our existing code as our template, and we have a machine code transformer to produce new versions. And this is what the Shore called metamorphic. And kind of the way you build this is you build what Shore called a mutation engine, where we have a little disassembler. And what does a disassembler mean? For the most part, the big thing we need is to figure out how long the instructions are. We also, as we'll see, we need to identify when instructions reference other instructions. And possibly, if we're doing other transformations, we might want other information like what registers are used. But the biggest thing we need, the most important thing, is we need to know where instructions begin and end and when they reference other instructions. So we get a bunch of instruction lengths and also some other instruction metadata. We transform that typically with some sort of lookup table for other versions of the same instruction, possibly longer ones. And then we do relocation, by which I mean fixing up places where instructions reference another. So if like we have a loop, we're going to have some jumps to the beginning of the loop. We need to fix those, even though we might have changed the length of that loop. So it's kind of surprising that this is practical, at least on x86, where we learned the instruction encoding is complicated and the manual has thousands of instructions. And we mentioned like a big way this is practical is that, well, typically this malware only needs to transform instructions that are in the malware itself. So that disassembler component and that transformation component only needs to deal with the instructions they've chosen to care about. So we're gonna have an example of Evol, which is one of these viruses. It had this kind of transformation where it said, okay, here's another way of writing this move instruction. And it basically had a table to look that up and do the transformation, presumably with some, you know, identifying the registers to maybe make this table smaller. That's not actually necessary. And this made the code get bigger each time, but they weren't really concerned about that. Like, the important thing to them is that they were kind of making random choices about what transformation to use, so this would be annoying to make a pattern to match. And the challenge here, as I mentioned, was dealing with the references to other instructions. And this seems kind of tedious to do, but there's a pretty mechanical process that makes this possible. And basically, a way you can do this is you can track the length of the original instructions and the transformed instructions, and you can kind of make a table. And then when you see something like this JNE here, you can say, okay, this goes to what was originally this XOR instruction. And you can figure that out by looking at its relative offset and looking at the original length table. You see, oh, this goes probably minus decrypt. This is going to be encoded as like -7. And you can figure out in the table, oh, that means we're going back 7 from the end of the jump. We're going to this XOR here. And you can look at the table and say, oh, that means what we really want to do is we want to go back 3 + 5 + 1 + 7. And we can edit the relative jump accordingly based on that information. So questions on sort of what's going on here, that how we're sort of recomputing the relative jump with our table of lengths. And we can do a similar transformation for absolute addresses. We can say we know the new starting address and the old starting address. We can figure out what instruction it corresponds to and then redo that computation on the new lengths of our transform instructions. So this gives us kind of a two-pass mechanism. So especially because we can have, I'm only showing jumps going backwards, but we can also have forward jumps. So the way you typically do this is you'd like save a list of the things you have to fix up, and then do a second pass where you have the whole table for everything you transformed, and then, you know, sum things up in that table to do your computations of what you should replace in each of those slots. Yeah. So this is all managed by the virus code, yeah.
Okay, so what if, you said it couldn't like grow to like a very large length because you're multiplying it, like the operations are growing each time it replicates, right? So what if it goes over the number of the allocated space of the virus?
So the question is, doesn't this have a problem where our transformations can make this grow too large to fit somewhere? So if we're appending, we can deal with this. And I guess, so I don't know exactly what the virus actually did for like the extreme case, but if we're appending, this doesn't come up for a very long time. The other case where it might come up is if this jump has a 1 byte displacement, like that could be a problem, but you could obviously avoid that by knowing how to generate a jump with a Fordite displacement, in which case it will fake. You should never end up exceeding that, or you probably run out of other resources first and crash. Does that answer your question? Other questions? But yeah, good, like, how to say. So we have this like fancy way where we have all these variants. What do antivirus software makers do about this? And what Soar says is basically that they look at the types of things the transformations can generate, and they make a little state machine because they know what the operations are and what they can look like. And they kind of manually or semi-manually build a state machine detector for it. So like it does have a signature, it's just not easy to describe. But it is the sort of thing you can, it is still deterministic enough. There's only variants that you can detect it, and that's what antivirus makers did, but it's a lot more labor than it was to make a detector for a traditional malware. So another thing that some of malware which use this strategy of like having a disassembler and this generic transformation is that if you can do this, you can use this as an infection technique, that you can make your mutator work on not just your own machine code, but the machine code of the program you're infecting. And this gives us kind of a view where we can like take our original application and mix it with our virus code and like just like actually insert the virus code somewhere randomly in the middle, or maybe not randomly, and rewrite the instructions to fix up all the references, to skip over that and make it look, you know, like it would have been there pretty much. And there were some very advanced viruses that used this strategy, and they just needed to have a mutation engine which handled most of the instructions you'd see in a real program. And this again seems really hard, but note that even though there's a ton of stuff in x86, a lot of it isn't generated by compilers typically, so it's probably not that bad to do. Questions on this? And I promised earlier when we talked about ways of hiding code from analysis, I mentioned that one strategy was emulation-based obfuscation, which is kind of related to this. In both of these cases, we're like kind of, you know, taking our code and putting it into another format kind of automatically. And I mentioned Tigris has this obfuscation transformation where it takes the code and basically turns it into a code for a virtual machine, and it makes a custom virtual machine. And talk just about how that idea works, because this is an idea that like is also another, you know, common idea for avoiding analysis of programs. That you basically invent a little instruction set and have an interpreter for that instruction set. And this means that all your classic techniques for analyzing the code, now you have a new type of code to analyze, which you can't really tell what it does until you look at that data, which is the code for this in this new instruction set. And what Tigris does is it generates a little stack-based machine. So like that stack, like our classic stack-based calculator that we use in this example in CSO1, it has a virtual machine that works that way, and it just makes up operands that work on that stack. It has some generic ones that it just always uses, like pushing a value onto the stack, or pushing a value looked up from a table onto the stack, which is like what it uses for strings. And then it, like, when there's a function to call, it, like, will generate an opcode for that function call. You know, and things to access locals. And it will also kind of generate instructions for different calculations on things like for a function. You know, a function, this would include calculations, etc. So it will just turn it into like a stack machine program is what they chose to do. There's other, you could do this with a register-based machine too, but that's the transformation we're doing. And this is like not a principled technique because there's nothing which says you can't do all the analysis we can do on a normal, you know, machine on this. Also, like, you can probably maybe detect automatically you have something that works like this. But that's what they do, so they just turn this into a little program. So, like, push 10, push the argument x, have an operand that does the comparison, then have an operand that does a conditional based on the, you know, the truth of the value on top of the stack. So you can see that this is a very mechanical process, and basically you're just reusing a C compiler, but using different code generation. I say just, like, obviously it's not simple to reuse a C compiler and change out the code generation, but it's using, like, they're taking advantage of existing infrastructure here. Like, that's why this is a practical technique for people to do. And what they end up with, and sort of the thing you have, is this, you know, kind of what a classic language interpreter looks like, and something that's, like, not inherently suspicious, because this is also the kind of way, like, a Python or Lua interpreter would work, and those appear in lots of legitimate programs. But where we have a loop, we have a virtual program counter or a virtual stack pointer, and we just do things based on what the value at the program counter, which is our opcode. And yeah, the challenge is that, like, this is not necessarily a sign of a malicious program, it's just a sign of an interpreter, and there's lots of legitimate uses of interpreters. So that's, and I'm putting that here because, like, that kind of ties into this idea of mutating the code. This is, like, one extreme version of mutating the code, is that we turn it into a completely new instruction set and have an interpreter running it. Okay, so to finish up talking about kind of this cat and mouse game, I'm going to talk about some miscellaneous sort of anti-analysis detection things. So one thing that comes up is that kind of an obvious strategy, especially for self-replicating malware, is let's just put, you know, if this malware is infecting every executable file on the system, let's put an executable file somewhere where it should never change. And this is a real strategy that anti-malware software often uses. So what do malware makers do in response to this? Well, they try to figure out if, is this a file that's just put there to, you know, trick me into infecting it. So often, you know, one thing they could do, of course, is they could know this malware managed the file this way and all that. And obviously, the malware is going to try to defeat that by randomizing things. So often they use kind of heuristics when looking at the file before infecting it. So they'll say, you know, if the program is a weird size, maybe don't infect it. You know, it's probably not interesting. It might be a trick. If the program has, like, lots of maps, maybe don't infect it. You can imagine other sort of heuristics that they'd end up using. And this is why, what happens in practice, why that strategy, which seems very straightforward, if you think about Vienna, right, Vienna just looks at every executable file, so that seems like an easy way to detect it. That's how, you know, they responded to, well, it was an easy way to detect it, so that's how the malware makers responded to it, is that they have heuristics about what they actually infect when they're doing self-replication to avoid hitting these traps that would be deliberately set. And so this means as an anti-malware maker, you need to think about, you know, how, what is the malware author going to do when they know you're looking? And you need to make sure, like, it looks as much like the real scenario as practical. So questions about this, you know, sort of idea of what the Shore calls goat file, sacrificial goats, and this, these detection ID guesses. And I would say this is also why, you know, this sort of sacrificial goat strategy not working is why most anti-malware software probably really wants to hook operations on real files. It's not good enough to just have. And this means, of course, that they risk interfering with legitimate programs by doing that. So another thing we didn't exactly talk about was debugger. So we talked about emulators as a nice powerful tool for analyzing what programs are doing, but there's a kind of higher performance, simpler tool of debuggers. And a lot of malware tries to avoid being run in debuggers. And some of the techniques we saw for emulation work there, right? We can make our program behave inconsistently. We can make our program check how much time things are taking, and that might interfere with, you know, our debugger stopping at some point. But often there are techniques that specifically target things debuggers do. And I guess I should mention, I thought I had a slide on it, but I should mention the most explicit thing that you can do if you want to care about debuggers. Often there's like an API call for, am I being debugged? So that is one thing malware will often do, but obviously that's kind of a simple thing, conceptually at least, to fix. You can just look for that call and change it. But there's more specific things you can do to attack the two kind of biggest pieces of debugger functionality, which are breakpoints. So like I say there's a function or line of code or an instruction I want to stop at, let's make that happen, and single stepping. So breakpoints mean that we run your program normally, but when you get somewhere, it stops. Single stepping means we run your program one instruction at a time. And there's actually, as we'll mention, hardware support for doing single stepping. Which is why the primary reason is kind of efficient. And single stepping is also how debuggers kind of fall back to implementing features like, you know, we mentioned you could have watch points and conditional breakpoints. The kind of last resort way of implementing that is you single step and you check the condition after each instruction. So let's first talk about breakpoints. And to talk about sort of ways that malware tries to interfere with breakpoints, we should talk about how do you implement a breakpoint. So someone have an idea, how would you implement a breakpoint? So let's say I'm in my debugger, I'm in GDB, and I type break foo. How could you implement that? Yeah? Okay, so one idea is we run the program, and I mentioned the single stepping mode, and then we check the PC every time, see if we're a foo. I agree that would work. Unfortunately, that's very slow. So can someone think of a faster way of implementing this? Yeah?
Maybe like you patch a breakpoint instruction in, and you check if the instruction
is a breakpoint
instruction?
Yeah, so you say we'll modify the code where we want the breakpoint to call the debugger. And that's exactly kind of the generic strategy many debuggers use. So let's say I want a breakpoint there. Basically, we're going to modify the code in memory to have a jump to the debugger there instead. Now, how do you do this exactly is a little tricky. So if you remember the x86 encoding, Some instructions are very short, and a generic jump isn't. So to do this, we want an instruction that we know is very short, because we want to set the breakpoint here, and we don't want to break code that might jump directly to that sub. Right? We can't overwrite part of that sub. That would break, could break other code that shouldn't hit our breakpoint. And x86 and most other architectures have a minimum length instruction that we can use to patch in here. So it's not going to be a normal jump. Instead, on x86, conventionally, it's the instruction int3, which is encoded with 1 byte xcc. And this has the nice property that, you know, since it's 1 byte, we can always replace an instruction with it because all instructions are a whole number of bytes. So this is kind of the classic technique on x86 for implementing breakpoints, is that we patch the code to have the CC where we want the breakpoint, and we save a copy later so we can actually run the normal code again. If that's when we continue, the simplest way of doing it is, I mentioned we have the single stepping mode, so you unpatch it, you single step, run one instruction until you get advanced beyond it, run an instruction, then you repatch it and then continue normally. And this instruction invokes a handler in the US. If you've taken CS02, it causes an exception. The debugger on a modern OS can tell the OS, hey, I'm debugging this program. When there's a debugging exception, run me. On an older OS, the debugger might be part of the OS effectively and set a handler directly. But either way, the debugger arranges to run when the, as a result of this instruction executing. Yes?
How do they deal with like relative addressing? For like, for example, let's say we set like a breakpoint at like 1,000, and then at 500, we jump to like, what was originally at 1,500?
So the question is, how do we deal with relative addressing? So because we're replacing code here, and we're actually not replacing it with jump debugger code, we're replacing it with int3, there's no relative addressing. So the way the hardware figures out what code to go to is that there's a table the OS sets up that says, here's where the handler for the debugger operation is. And it's looking at that table. So it can set whatever location it wants. It doesn't need to worry about relative versus absolute. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? Okay, so this is kind of our conventional way of handling that. And I mentioned earlier that one of the things that Tigris did as a transformation is it did checksumming code, that it would check the machine code hasn't been altered. And this is one of the things that that interferes with, is debuggers for this reason. Because it's hard, it's very, you can't really, if you patch the code, if you read that machine code, it's now different. So you can just have code that runs and reads it and checks if it's changed. So this is one thing code might do to just defeat debuggers. It just checks if it has the machine code changed. If so, you know, I'm just going to, you know, not execute the interesting code. And the other thing to do is just like check, is there a handler for this int3 thing? Or like the Windows API function, is debugger present? As I said, this is easier to deal with, but another thing a lot of malware or code that just for some reason is obfuscated through word analysis will do. So what is kind of the defense to this? So one thing we can do is we can like get rid of this checksumming code. If you're running in an emulator, it's fairly straightforward to have the code read different data than is actually executed. But that's not really straightforward on a running system. I can imagine ways of doing it, but they're not fast. Now, I imply that like this int three-way, this is how we do breakpoints, and indeed is how breakpoints have traditionally been done. It's still a mechanism debuggers use, but there's another more modern mechanism that's a little limited, but is more efficient than that. And that x86 has a bunch of debug registers, DR0 through DR7, and the first four of them are breakpoint registers. So instead of patching code, you can have the OS set these registers for you, and if you put the address of an instruction there, it will trigger something like the int3 automatically when that PC is reached. There's basically a comparator on the processor that says, is PC equal to debug register 0? Is it equal to debug register 1? If so, run the OS. And if you're worried about what about programs checking this, there's like a flag to check if debug registers are attempt to be used, so you can do nested debugging. They've thought about this, but the problem here is that this supports 4 breakpoints, which is not really, so you wouldn't be happy if GDB said, you set 4 breakpoints, too bad. So debuggers generally will fall back or maybe uses their primary mechanism, the int3, because of that, even though there is this hardware support. And this kind of hardware support is going to be different on every architecture, but it's pretty common to have something like this because it's really useful to have the hardware help you out with this stuff. So that's about sort of breakpoints. So the other feature I mentioned was single stepping. And on x86, there's a processor flag that enables single stepping. And the way that works is basically after every instruction, the OS gets run when that flag is set. The flag happens to be something you can just read. Like you can use an instruction like push F on x86 to copy the flags, all of them, including this one, to the stack, and then read that and figure out if it sets. So, you can just check directly. Now a clever debugger or OS might, figure out a way of like changing how the push F works, because we can look at what instruction you're running and fix that. But that's a thing can do. The other things that some malware might do is you can like check the timing. Like obviously enabling this mode makes everything run really slow because we're running the OS handler between even like two add instructions. And we can also like try to register our own single step handler and see what happens. So that's on debugging. So I think all of these are like things we can work around, but they're things that malware will often do that are going to make it more annoying to apply our standard debugging techniques to a program. And I mentioned emulation first. Emulation's much more powerful and much more resistant to these techniques, because with an emulator, we don't need to modify the machine code to set a breakpoint. We can just change how our emulator generates the actual instructions it runs or like goes through the instructions, but that's a lot slower than even single stepping is most likely. So the other thing that is kind of a straightforward thing for malware to do is if we know about anti-malware software, we can just like change it directly. There's a signature database. Just remove your signature from that. You can just, install your own hooks for all the things the antivirus software is supposed to be checking. Check them on behalf of the antivirus software and say that everything's fine. Another thing a simpler strategy is some anti-malware software uses tries to avoid scanning files multiple times. Because we mentioned with complicated patterns, Or if we're talking about, like I mentioned, we have this detector for that metamorphic virus, right? That's complicated. We don't want to run that very often. So they'll often try to check if files have changed, so you can try to defeat that checking. And some unsmart anti-malware software uses checksums, basically hashes, that are not cryptographically secure, so you can deliberately make your infection, your modification, not change that hash. And a lot of malware software has done that, has said, oh, they're using CRC32, that's not a cryptographic hash, we can add something to the end to make the CRC32 value stay the same, and they just do that. So the other big category of this is something I believe that was mentioned in Intro Cyber as what we'll call like rootkits, that we can do the sort of techniques that anti-malware software uses to like figure out what programs are doing on the system and like filtering out bad accesses to interfere with the anti-malware software's attempt to monitor the system. So we can say, I'm going to have this special handler for open, and when you try to open the program I have infected, you're going to be opening this other file. It's not going to tell you, just going to open that other file. So this is the kind of thing a rootkit will do. We mentioned that like anti-malware software really liked being able to look at all the open calls, all the weed calls, to like figure out what programs were doing, to scan for things. The same mechanism lets the malware make those calls behave poorly for us. And it's the same techniques, because we want to interfere with calls to the operating system, exactly the same techniques. And it also means that if we believe in anti-malware software, we can't just say no program is allowed to do this, because we have legitimate reasons to do things that are replacing the open file function. Maybe not one that looks like this, but legitimate things to do with that. And so we can override sort of lots of operations like this. We can like override get the modification times. Nope, none of these files have changed. This directory doesn't have any of the malware files, just the normal files. You know, when you get that list. You know, when you read the file, oh, that cavity there is empty, just nops or zeros. When you list the processes, yeah, malware.exe isn't on that list, weird. You know, these are common things where we'll just install, you know, sort of intercept those calls to OS functions and change what they do. And this kind of is the central idea of a rootkit, I believe. So who covered this in Intro Cyber? Did not cover in Intro Cyber? So mix, okay. But this is kind of the central idea of what's called a rootkit. You know, a stealthy rootkit is that like it's interfering with these operations that would allow its detection. And this is probably one area where the idea of application whitelisting we talked about at the beginning of talking about anti-malware techniques is actually most effective. Because, you know, whitelisting you mentioned was problematic because users typically don't want to have a very small list of applications they can run. But there's probably a very small list of applications which should have the ability to hook things like the open file call and change what they do. And so this is actually a thing we do, that typically only very specific programs are allowed to do this. And for example, on Windows, you need to be a driver to do this. And this is from Microsoft's page, that your drivers need to get signed in a particular way. So there's a limited number of people who are allowed to do this, and we know exactly who it is. And this would seem to make doing this kind of rootkit style thing of making self very well hiding malware a lot harder. And it's one area where you can probably tolerate more that whitelisting pain of not being able to run special things. I say more because, like, if I have a new piece of hardware and want to develop a device for it, I need this kind of access. It's not great to have to go through hoops for that. But it's more tolerable than just saying, welcome to BigCorp. You can run the list of programs the IT people have done. If you want to install a new program, you get to send an email to someone and wait a week. That's a better story for that. Now, the problem with this idea in practice is that it's really valuable to get the keys to sign something as a trusted company, and these keys are needed all the time to do development of these drivers, and commonly, it's not development of things that like hook things, but the same access is what you need for developing like a video card driver. And so that means that we have stories like this, like that it's been relatively easy for malware authors to find some company which did not secure their keys and had a legitimate reason to be developing code with this access, but did not secure the keys used to sign that. So questions about our signing? So a complaint you might have is that this is about driver signing, and what most drivers do isn't anything like all the stuff I talked about malware rootkits doing to hide themselves, right? Most drivers don't interfere with the list of running processes. Most drivers don't change, don't hide open files. Like, why is that access that the video driver has to our system, for example? And that it has that access means that you can steal keys from someone who makes a video driver or other device, classic device drivers. And in fact, it doesn't have to be the case. But typically the reason why is that if you're taking CSO2, you learned about kernel mode. But basically, the processor has two modes it can run in, one with full hardware access, one without. And in most OS designs, code that interfaces directly with the hardware runs in that full access mode. And since it has full access, it also has access to these things which might be irrelevant to it, but allow it to, sort of change the list of running processes and so on. So there are OS designs which don't have this problem. None of them are popular for desktop or laptop system or even mobile phone systems today, but they exist. You might say, why aren't we using one of those? Like, why does a random device driver have permission to modify the list of running processes? And the reason is that there's real either performance and or sort of complexity cost that we need hardware to do extra stuff for us, or we need to do things that are slower for our device drivers. And if you're thinking about like a graphics driver, that's a real concern. So, that's not the design we've settled on for pretty much all modern OSs, even though, we know how to build OSs where, your driver for your, tablet or USB doesn't have full access to everything. Some questions? So, I talked about this rootkit idea. So have any ideas, how can we detect one of these rootkits? What should we look for if we want to detect one? Yeah. Okay, so we can check the list of drivers. That seems like a nice idea. Other ideas? Yeah.
I feel like you can't really trust anything in the OS to tell you about the compromised OS. So I feel like the only real solution is to turn off the computer.
Okay, so we can scan the system from outside the OS, okay? And how about ways that will, so I'm gonna talk about a program that does something which obviously won't always work, but what are some ideas which will sometimes work? Which, what are ways we could take advantage of sloppiness of our root could author? What are ways our root could author might be sloppy? Yeah. So we can look for multiple ways to do the same thing and see if they missed one. So that's one thing, yeah, one big idea here. And so to give a concrete example, check rootkit is a Unix program that's intended to look for rootkits. And obviously it can't always work, but if you look at the checks they're doing, they're looking for cases where the rootkit was sloppy. They missed something. So one thing they do is they look at system programs and see, are the strings in here normal? Because a lot of rootkits modify, a lot of the way rootkits will work is they'll modify like the they'll modify not the process listing system operation, but the process listing program. So they'll check, does the process listing program have weird things in it? And other programs for monitoring the system, because that's a lot easier than modifying the system calls up. Often, they'll look at multiple ways of like listing the processes and see, do these all list the same processes? Not, something's wrong. And things like, you know, you can get a list of files and you can get how many files are in the directory. Sometimes malware won't fix up, won't realize, oops, there's multiple ways of querying that. So look for various things like that. File names that they know are correlated with specific rootkits. Now these are all kind of like, I know what a specific rootkit looks like here, let me, you know, look for signs of it that are kind of holes they left, because typically they don't dot all their I's and cross all their T's, because it's a lot hard to do. There's a lot of stuff, ways the OS has of querying what's going on. And even though conceptually you could get them all, they often don't. Okay, so questions? Right. Okay, so our topic for next time is we're going to start talking about exploits. So my plan is to talk about command injection, which should be review. Command injection is the more general idea that's behind SQL injection. And depending how I feel about time, then I might talk about an analysis technique called dynamic taint tracking. Briefly, very briefly, and then we'll start talking about memory overflows. And we're going to go into lots and lots of detail about memory overflows and how to exploit them, how to avoid them being exploited, and so on. So that's where I'll finish up today.